Welcome to the Red Rain Podcast. Here is your host from Revenge of the Birds, Walter Mitchell.
Thank you, Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter, who's took the ride down from Sacramento to San Diego. He gets a nice few days off due to the NBA All-Star break and his coverage of the Sacramento Kings. So that's cool for him. And so delighted to have him with us today to talk about the top of this draft in the NFL in 2024. Fascinating scenarios, interesting discussions, dilemmas for each team. Going to go through each team at the top and talk about what the scenarios are and what we might expect. But the more and more that I look at the scenarios, the more and more convinced I have become that Monty is going to have a deal he cannot refuse at number four, which would behoove him to take. And like last year, I mean, the fans were all locked in on Will Anderson Jr. and understandably so. Fans were, you know, were posting him in Cardinal Red all over Twitter. That did not happen, as we know. And this year it's Marvin Harrison Jr. In my opinion, MHJ is not going to make it to four to begin with. So it becomes a moot point. And I'll explain some of the reasons why I believe that. But if we want to start with the Chicago Bears at number one, you know, this is a tantalizing dilemma for them because, you know, Matt Eberflus, the head coach, was retained. They like what he was doing on defense down the stretch last year. They were winning games with Justin Fields at quarterback. There were real improvements and strides there. And, you know, in an NFC North that is imminently winnable for any of those teams. If you look at what the Bears did down the stretch and the confidence they built by sticking with Justin Fields and by trading the number one pick, it's very likable they could pick up where they left off. Whereas if you bring in a rookie like Caleb Williams, you're sort of like resetting and you have to be realistic. I mean, unless he's a C.J. Stroud who can come in and, you know, win right away. Well, C.J. Stroud actually didn't win right away. The team, you know, sort of grew around him and then suddenly they were winning. And, you know, of course, all of that would be possible, but I think it's less likely to happen with Caleb Williams. So, you know, and Williams is a polarizing figure. I mean, we've got to acknowledge that, you know, he's not the slam dunk that people thought he would be for the last 2 years because of some of the, you know, emotional baggage that, you know, that went on at USC this year, some of the drop off in the quality of his play, et cetera. So,
You know, Walter, just real brief, I'm not sure I agree with your prognostication of the state of the Chicago Bears right now. I mean, they ended the season 5-3 in the win-loss column, and one of those losses, they had a 14-point fourth-quarter lead against the Detroit Lions. Right. And Justin Fields wasn't a stud quarterback by any stretch of the imagination statistically the back half of the season. I think they might be right on the precipice of getting to that 9-10 win range, and it wouldn't necessarily be needing a dramatic jump like the Texans needed post D'Amico Ryans and CJ Stroud coming in the door last year.
Yeah. So you think just to replace Fields with Caleb Williams is going to get that done?
No, because I don't believe Caleb Williams is that dramatically an upgrade versus Justin Fields talent-wise. That doesn't necessarily mean he won't come in and have better production, but I think talent-wise they aren't that dramatically different from each other.
Right. So if you're advising the Bears, what do you do? How do you advise them?
That is a question I've been thinking about for about a month at this point. I think you're as good as the offers on the table if you're Chicago, but they as an organization don't really seem committed to Justin Fields. And I've heard some people bring up this interesting scenario that I actually tend to agree with in this case, which is you draft a quarterback regardless of whether it's Fields regardless of whether it's Williams or Drake May. And then you kind of give Fields the first 8 weeks of the season to kind of figure it out, like kind of bridging the gap between the two quarterbacks. But I think at this point, if you're Chicago, you go ahead and take the quarterback. But again, you're going to talk about with the Cardinals pick, you're only as good as the options that are on the table to trade down.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the thing about Fields that makes him potentially special is his running ability. He improved something as a passer last year, and I would expect that to continue. He's got good weapons around him. And, you know, imagine a scenario like this. This is what I'm imagining. And, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, there are people who are absolutely convinced that they're going to trade Fields to, like, Atlanta. And Fields, I think, has scrubbed his socials. Here we go again. And is suddenly following, you know, like Bijan Robinson. So this could all be moot. But maybe it's not. I mean, the draft evaluations are going on as we speak. Nothing is set in stone. The interviews at the Combine will be, instrumental and paramount. So lots going to happen between now and April. But I imagined a scenario where they got the Washington Commanders to move up one spot, and they got a second-round pick at 36 and a second-round pick in 2025 to be able to make that one spot jump. Of course, that would mean that the Commanders would be in a position to take Caleb Williams at number one, which reunites him with Cliff Kingsbury. Something that everyone who's been paying attention thinks that the Commanders would want to do because of the connection to Kingsbury. I mean, no one knows Caleb Williams, you know, who's currently employed in the NFL right now, as well as Cliff Kingsbury. So, and if Cliff's like, this guy's the guy, you know, we're going to sacrifice two second round picks to do this, but in consecutive years, but, you know, it could be worth it. So, you know, then the Bears at two could take Marvin Harrison Jr. And I mean, the enticing trifecta of weapons they could have with Marvin Harrison Jr. at X and DJ Moore at Z and Cole Kmet at Y. I mean, oh my goodness. whoa. I mean, that for any quarterback, that would be a dream scenario. So, and I just think of Marvin Harrison as that kind of special player that teams are going to try to maneuver around in the top of this draft to take, because there's another scenario at three that's quickly developing here in New England, is that the word this morning out of New England is that they could make quite a push to sign Baker Mayfield. And the reason is that Alex Van Pelt was just hired on their offensive staff, and Van Pelt was touted as being the coach on the Browns that got the most out of Baker Mayfield in that playoff year that they had, where they beat the Steelers in the first round of the playoffs, and in Mayfield's best season as a Brown. Which then the next year, Mayfield, as we saw, tried to play through some pretty devastating injuries. You know, we know the story from there. But I think the Patriots would prefer to sign a quarterback that fits their mode, and you know, the connection with Van Pelt is very alluring. And you know, with what's going on down in Tampa, Baker Mayfield might be very inclined to take a deal up in New England, because you know, he lost his coach, you know, who's now the head coach in Carolina, Canales, and then he lost. You know, chances are they're not going to tag Mike Evans in Tampa. It looks as if they're going to let Mike Evans test the waters elsewhere. And, you know, Tampa's kind of a team in transition right now, so we don't really know. I think if the Patriots, I mean, I was hearing figures like Tampa would offer him 3 years, $100 million. And, you know, 33.3 a year. I think he can get more than that on the open market. You know, I don't think anyone's going to sign him in the 50, you know, range, but I think 40 gets it done, and on a 3 year deal, like 120, and with incentives. And Mayfield had an outstanding year. There's no doubt about it. He's resurrected his career, and you know, he was pesky and showed excellent arm strength, and you know, aplomb in what he was doing. And I could see something like that happen, because then, you know, New England will be in a position to take one of these world-class receivers, either Harrison or Malik Nabers. And that in itself is such a great debate, the Harrison versus Nabers, because they're a study in contrasts. And, you know, for example, if you wanted to, I've been working on this for an article on Revenge of the Birds, is that, you know, if you wanted to compare Malik Nabers to Marvin Harrison Jr., check this out, okay? So we're going to turn to the PFF grades. They're 2023 PFF grades. Overall, Nabers had the higher grade, 92.9 to 89.9. He had the higher receiving grade, 93.1 to 89.6. He had a better drop rate percentage, 5.3 to 8.2 for Harrison. He had a better contested catch percentage, 45.5 to 44.3. He had a better versus man coverage grade of 90.8 to 82.6. And their numbers, you know, I mean, Nabers had, here's the big one for me, is that, you know, he had 89 catches and 128 targets for 69.5%, whereas Harrison had 67 catches and 114 targets at 58.8%. And then with that, Nabers had 1,568 yards, and Harrison had 1,211. Both of them had 14 TDs. You know, so those numbers, now here's another factor, is I think we'd all can agree that performing at this level in the SEC is also a feather in Malik Nabers' cap. I mean, you're playing in the best conference in the country, top to bottom, and you're putting up these kind of numbers. So, you know, that's fascinating to me, because, you know, it's, you know, it's a dilemma in what you want. You know, you want the big, tall, 6'4", sub 4.45 speed receiver. I think that, you know, I think that MHJ is going to run 4.4 something. Maybe even top 4.38, something like that. That's going to be so enticing. But the other thing in today's football is versatility. I mean, who's the more versatile player, Kyle? Is it Marvin Harrison Jr., or is it Malik Nabers?
That's a great question. I suppose versatility, I would go Malik Nabers, but right. Do you need versatility when you have Marvin Harrison Jr., who is as physical a receiver as anyone else and one of the best one-on-one receivers that's come out of the draft as long as I can remember?
Well, in today's football, and I was arguing this week in my push for the Cardinals to strongly consider Brock Bowers, who's my favorite player for the Cardinals this year because of the system. And because, you know, and I was doing a comparison between those two, between Harrison and Bowers. I mean, who's the superior athlete? You'd have to say Harrison Jr., but it's not by, you know, by miles.
Saying Brock Bowers is not a ridiculous physical specimen is a crazy thing to say. I mean, Brock Bowers is, I joke that he's like Gronk. He's like a polar bear that's out there catching passes. Like, he's open even when he's not open, but you could say the same thing about Marvin Harrison Jr. They're both incredible physical specimens in a way that Malik Nabers is an incredible athlete, but is not the same physical build as those two guys.
Right, right. And, you know, it's Bowers' versatility and his uncanny completion percentage and playing in Drew Petzing's 12 and 13 personnel opposite Trey McBride, I think would be unstoppable for the Cardinals. You know, with the way Kyler connected with McBride, imagine if he has those. I think the Bowers is more readily accessible in that offense to throw to. He's just as big a target, you know, and I think he's going to run sub 4.5. I mean, as a junior at Georgia, he ran 4.5 with a 40-inch vertical. I mean, at 6'4", 240. You know, but, I mean, and then you make the case that, I mean, Brock Bowers over the middle is a total dog. I mean, he's a yard after catch, maven. So here's how I broke it down, was that here's the concern I have about Harrison is that, you know, his 58% completion percentage, 68 catches on 114 targets. You look at Bowers last year, 56 catches on 71 targets for 78.7. I mean, that's 20 percentage points higher. Then the drop rate, you had Harrison at 8.2, Bowers 5.1. And then yard after catch, Harrison Jr., who was better this year, that was one of the raps against him, had 6.4, but Bowers had 8.7, which is outstanding. Career completion percentages. Harrison, 62.5%, 155 catches on 242 targets. That's with playing with C.J. Stroud, you know, I mean, too. I mean, and then Bowers, this is phenomenal. 175 catches on 224 targets for 71.1%. And then, you know, you look at their college production, career yards from scrimmage. Who would you guess had more, Harrison or Bowers?
That's actually a great question. I'm not 100% sure. I'm going to guess, I'll guess Bowers.
You were right.
Okay.
Harrison, 2,671. This includes rushing, too.
Yeah.
Each of them had rushing statistics. And Bowers at 2,731.
Okay.
Who had more career TDs?
Oh, that's definitely going to be Brock Bowers.
No, it was Harrison with 32 and Bowers with 31.
Really? Okay.
I mean, it's that close, right?
Yeah, it's basically a tie. Wow, that is surprising. I mean, I guess I'm going to guess a higher percentage of Ohio State scores were Harrison Jr. versus Brock Bowers because of Washington being there at the same time as Bowers and Ladd McConkey and some of the other guys that they had.
Right. I mean, this includes rushing stats. This is phenomenal for a tight end. Average yards per touch for Bowers was 14.1. I mean, typically for tight ends, you're hovering around that 11. A good average yards is about 11 or 12. And it's just his run after catch ability, Bowers, is just special.
And here's a testament to how good these players are. In October of last year, it was the game where Bowers injured himself. They were playing against, I believe it was the University of Tennessee. Or no, it was Auburn. They were playing Auburn, and they were losing early in the game, and then Bowers scored, I think, two or three touchdowns late in the game, and people were saying after that, Brock Bowers is the best player in college football this season. And then he got hurt, obviously. And then November came around and people were saying Marvin Harrison Jr. is the best player in college football. Both of these guys had laid claim to being the best players in college football last season.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And you know, again, it's so what I look at is the system, you know, where you're coming into. And, you know, because of Petsing and his wanting to run a ball control offense out of 12 and 13 personnel, I mean, it's old school Patriots and what Tom Brady made, you know, vogue, which helped him capture six rings, was you beat teams' defenses over the middle by running the ball and having play action off of the runs. And then you have a wave. You have, you know, like of if your first look, which is straight down the seam, isn't open, then you come underneath it with a tight end or, you know, or a crossing wide receiver, like a slot, like a Julian Edelman. If he's not open, then you circle a running back into the vacated area. And, you know, I always made the analogy of, you know, back in my Pac-Man playing days, was the only way to escape the ghost was the best way to was to escape through the middle and go out those doors in the middle and go back on the other side. In essence, what I've learned in the NFL over the last, you know, over the Brady years is that if you can win in the middle of the football field offensively, you can not only dominate ball control, you can win a lot of games. And I mean, the perimeter is great, no doubt, but the Patriots weren't ever that great on the perimeter, not post Randy Moss. So, and that was a long, long time ago. So, you know, but winning over the middle, and look at Mahomes, how he's picked up on that. I mean, I would argue the most valuable offensive player receiver-wise the last 5 years has been Travis Kelce. Would you concur with that?
It's either Kelce or call it Justin Jefferson. But regardless, I think the thing that Kelce has done better than anyone I've ever seen is getting space in the middle of the field. Like him, his ability to get open and create space in the middle of the field is second to none that I've ever seen in NFL history. No Tony Gonzalez, no Rob Gronkowski. Like they put double teams on Kelce in the middle of the field and he's still able to find space. And him and Mahomes have that timing route down to perfection in such a way that the ball's out before Kelce turns, but Kelce knows he's going to be open when he makes that turn to the right. I mean, their ability to connect in the middle of the field is second to none, in the same way that you talked about the Patriots were scheming open things in the middle of the field.
Right. And here's my clincher argument for Bowers over anyone else in this draft for a playmaker, is that you can't play zone against Bowers. He's like Kelce. I mean, you can't play zone against Kelce. He's a zone buster. If you watch Georgia play against zones, he picks them apart every time. He's that savvy and that big a target. He's going to find the gray areas and he's going to exploit them. And then he's a run after the catch, dog. So, you know, so then it what does it behoove you to do? It behooves you to play man, and sometimes even bracket a guy like that because of his slipperiness and getting open. So it can take occupy two defenders in man. You know, you got to give him help over the top, perhaps, because also Bowers has speed to beat you. So if it requires you to play man, that is the ultimate dream for a team with Kyler Murray at quarterback.
Can I ask you a quick question? And I don't want to derail the point completely. Do you think of Trey McBride as someone who can break zone defenses in a similar way?
Yes.
Okay.
But I also think, you know, if you have two guys like that, and I think this is going to come back to being a new rage in the NFL, is you saw what the Ravens did with Mark Andrews and then Isaiah Likely. I mean, when Andrews was out, they didn't miss a beat because Likely came right in and filled that role. But also, Todd Mongan ran a very Petsing-esque offense, which was pretty surprising, in Baltimore. Just real success with that running attack, running, and play action for Lamar. And this is what the Cardinals are trying to do. So, I mean, having two stud tight ends in a 12 package or a 13 package, and you have Elijah Higgins, who's a good receiver, you know, in 13 packages too. Wow. I mean, the pressure that puts on defenses, because who do you cover those guys with? You know, if you're in 12, you've got two wide receivers to have to defend. Who do you put them on linebackers? You put them on strong safeties? I mean, what do you do? And if you have two of them, it's like having two queens on the chessboard.
I'm going to make another quick addition here to your point. Last year, when the draft rolled around, the Buffalo Bills went out of their way to draft Dalton Kincaid in the first round to pair him and Dawson Knox in those same 12 personnel packages. And after 4 years of trying to get the run game down, getting that dual personnel package of Knox and Kincaid was able to finally open up the run game for James Cook in that offense.
That is an outstanding get on your part. And what a great example, a just outstanding get. And Kincaid has just scratched the surface of his talent. And we know the chemistry that Josh Allen has with Knox. I mean, that's pretty special. So, but getting back to this is that, so if we can dictate that teams are going to have to play us man to man, look at what that does for Kyler Murray, because the biggest fear that's why teams love to zone Kyler. This is how Brian Flores, you know, put in a blueprint of how to cover Kyler, was to zone him, not only versus the pass, but versus the run. And for a while, even Belichick copied it when we played New England in New England. And for a while, it was hard to solve because we didn't have the kind of zone busters we used to have with Larry and other things. And it was harder with a smaller quarterback to see over the middle in order to make those throws too. So it compounded it. But if you've got man-to-man, I mean, that behooves you. I mean, ask Nick Saban when he was going up against Kyler. He said, to paraphrase, he said, first of all, you got to have a spy on him the whole time. And second of all, for that matter, you probably need two spies because he's going to make the first spy miss. I mean, what you can't risk doing is running, five-on-five man coverage where patterns could leave the middle wide open for Kyler to just run through. I mean, that's the biggest fear defenses have against Lamar or any running quarterback. Is so if you're going to play a man, you got to play with a spy. So if you play with a spy, that takes a guy out of your coverage. And now, you know, maybe one of the safeties or one of the linebackers. So now what do you do? So now you have 5 against 6 versus 5 against 7. I mean, it's a chess game of that kind of proportion. And I like my chances with Kyler on 5 versus 6. Oh, my God. Versus 5 versus 7. Wow. And so all that makes sense to me. I mean, And you know, it's and that's why I like Neighbors too, because of his versatility. He can play all over the football field. And you know, he can play, you can motion him all around. You can with Harrison too. But in a different offense, you know, if you're playing verticals like they try to do in Las Vegas, you'd want Harrison. I mean, without a doubt. You know, and pair him up with other guys. But I think in our offense, it would make better sense for Bowers. But, you know, there's so what I if that comes true in New England, if they attract Baker Mayfield to come in there, I think you're going to see them take one of these, either Harrison or Neighbors at number three, to give Baker Mayfield. I mean, the Patriots are now doing things they didn't do under Belichick. They just hired, I don't know if you saw this, Kyle, but they have like 20 coaches now, which, you know, they're spreading out the coaching staff, which they've never done before. You know, they're bringing all sorts of assistants in, like Alex Van Pelt. And there's going to be a lot of input. And, you know, Belichick was loath to draft wide receivers in the first round. I think you're going to see one go this year if they get the quarterback they want, at number three. They're going to take Harrison or they'll take Neighbors, one of those two.
There's also some whispers of the Patriots possibly trading down from number three for that quarterback hungry team that might want to jump up and grab Jaden Daniels. I mean, I assume Jaden Daniels will be the third quarterback taken off the board, but I know that's still on the cards are on the table for the Patriots that way.
Yes, I think that's possible, particularly because it's such a deep draft in wide receiver. It is just so deep and talented at wide receiver. I mean, teams can wait and get a really good one on day two, and there's going to be some really good ones in round four. I mean, it's that deep. It's one of the deepest pool of wide receivers I've ever seen. I mean, I'm just watching tape of the kid Leggett from South Carolina. I mean, and he's like ranked like 10th by a lot of the pundits. You know, this kid can, oh my God, he's a baller. He's like a Deebo Samuels. You know, and you got, you know, the kid Xavier Worthy from Texas, just watching tape on him. Whoa. You know, and then there are guys who are going to make it to round four, like Jalen McMillan of Washington was a little dinged up this year, but that kid can scoop. And Jacob Cowing from Arizona is could be this year's Tank Dell. I mean, he's got special feet. Then you got the big receivers like Johnny Wilson. You got Troy Franklin. Roma Dunze, you know, Ja'Cory Brooks.
Even
I mean,
Keon Coleman over at Florida State.
Keon Coleman. I mean, but my favorite of all, because of his feet, and it's just is Roman Wilson of Michigan. And I'll tell you what, I mean, whoever gets him is going to get a steal. He's just special, and there's something about him that, you know, in the to put up the numbers he did in a run-oriented offense is pretty amazing too. And love what he did at the Senior Bowl. Plays bigger than his size suggests, but he floats effortlessly getting open on a football field, and he's got great hands, and he's got, you know, great nose for the end zone. I think he had 12 touchdowns last year. And right now, I can't find him on anybody's top 10 wide receiver. He's not on Mel's. He's not on DJs. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, this kid's a special talent, in my opinion.
I mean,
And
there's
can't
going to be
crack.
10 wide receivers drafted in the first two rounds. That's a
Yeah.
lot.
Yeah. I think, and, but I think teams might even wait. You know, same's true in a little lesser sense. You don't have the big name cornerbacks at the top, but the depth of the cornerback position in this draft is really solid, too. And you know, that's that bears watching. But I could see a scenario where Williams goes one to the Commanders, Harrison goes two to the Bears, and Neighbors goes three to the Patriots, which would mean in the four spot, the phone is going to be ringing off, you know, every hook in the building. It's, you know, in that case, so you still have Drake May there. You still have who I think is the best quarterback in this draft. If I were drafting a quarterback at the top of this draft, he's the one I'd want because of his combination of feet and that rocket arm of his. I really, and his size is impressive to me. So that combination, I think, is really good. And then, you know, you've got Jaden Daniels, who's going to be a high pick. So what I thought was what a trade that I think would make sense for the Cardinals in that scenario, it would be to trade with the Giants. You know, here's where the math really works for the Cardinals in trading down. Because you want to, you know, if you can envision the top of their draft board and how many players they'd be interested in taking in with their first pick. So you know there's going to be three quarterbacks going in the top probably six or seven. So, and the Cardinals aren't going to take a quarterback. So that, if you're talking the top 10, three are going to be quarterbacks. More than likely, between Bowers and the two receivers, three are going to be receivers, and possibly four with Roma Dunze, right? So that gives you up to six or seven. Then you have the three stud tackles, offensive tackles, in Alt, Fashanu, and Talese Fuaga. So there's nine or ten right there without even talking about a defensive guy. And on the defensive end, you got some interesting prospects there with Dallas Turner, Lateo Leitu, who, wow, I mean, I was watching his tape. This kid's special. I mean, I could see him being very high on the Cardinals board. And Monty, if he checks out medically, which he seems fine now after the neck scare he had earlier in his college career. Wow, I mean, could envision him on the Cardinals' edge big time. I mean, he has the potential to be top 12. You know, so if you do the math, and then you got two edge rushers there that are interesting. Then another guy that I think is worthy of top 12 is Byron Murphy, the second. You know, some Matt Miller calls him baby, baby Aaron, baby Aaron Donald. The kid is so explosive. He's smallish, but man, he packs power and he can get after the quarterback big time. I think he's going to be a huge riser in this draft. He'll be a top 10. So if you do the math on that, and then you also, you know, can consider some other top 10 kind of guys. Like, here's how I had him rank. And then you consider the corners. So corners that are rising up these draft boards, like Terrion Arnold. And I did a comparison on Arnold and Quinyon Mitchell, who I think probably will go 1-2 in the corners. Although, God, I love this kid, Cooper DeJean from Iowa. Awesome. He's going to be right up there. You know, Kool-Aid McKinstry, your guy. He's a fabulous player. I mean, these corners. But interesting, when you look at the stats between Quinyon Mitchell and Terrion Arnold, which are a bit skewed because Arnold played in the SEC while Quinyon Mitchell played in the MAC. So you have to factor that in. But Mitchell had a 91.5 overall, Arnold 88.3. you know, things like that. But Arnold had five interceptions last year. But you also have to factor in that, you know, that Arnold played in the slot way more than Arnold covered the slot 205 times, while Mitchell was only in the slot 55. That's playing the slot's going to skew your percentages.
Also, it's important to look at percentage, target percentage as well, because what happens with a lot of these star corners, especially in the MAC, they just stop throwing at those guys altogether. And so you're not going to get the interceptions or the deflections or the tackle numbers because they just stop throwing at you the way that, you know, Sauce Gardner gets no numbers in the NFL because teams have just decided we're just not going to throw at him, period.
Right. Yep. So, I mean, put it this way, the Cardinals could trade down to 10 or 12. And if they wound up with Talese Fuaga, would anyone complain? I mean, that guy's Rolo the Dancing Bear at right tackle. I mean, he's, I think he reminds me a lot of a maybe even more nimble Tristan Wirfs. You know, there's going to be an all-star type, Pro Bowl type player this deep in this draft if you trade down a few spots or within the top 12 or 13, I think, to where the numbers make sense. If you can add another, now the Cardinals come into the draft with more top 100 picks than any other team. They have six. And it wouldn't surprise me if Monty wants seven. Because, and here's the thing too, is that the Cardinals, you know, for right or for wrong, they did a lot of gutting of this this roster. And they got a lot of holes. And I don't know in free agency just how popular they're going to be, because particularly on defense where they need it the most, you now have, what is it, five new defensive-minded head coaches in the NFL? Unheard of. And with a lot of popular guys in there, like Quinn, you know, I mean, guys will want to play for. Dan Quinn and Mike McDonald from the Ravens, guys are going to be lining up to play for him up in Seattle. Dang it. But you go right through all those guys, there's going to be a lot of buzz surrounding those teams and the kind of defensive players they're going to be able to track. So I have a feeling that if free agency isn't as productive as the Cardinals are hoping, that's going to put even more pressure on filling the team needs through the draft. And if that's the case, the more picks, the merrier, gives you the more flexibility, et cetera. So, you know, that's where I think the math adds up. I know this will come as a huge disappointment to so many Cardinal fans who are so all in on Marvin Harrison. And believe me, I mean, I'll be jumping, doing cartwheels, if the Cardinals draft him. I mean, he's just such an amazing prospect. It's hard, you know, he'd be a fit on any team. Put him in there, put it that way. But kind of knowing Monty and going back to his Patriot roots and kind of the way that he evaluates players and Dave Sears, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if Joe Walt has a higher grade on their board than Marvin Harrison. And that's not to say disparage Marvin Harrison in any manner, shape, or form. And it wouldn't surprise me if they have tackle as being more of a priority than X, Y receiver. Also, I was very encouraged when Michael Wilson was playing the X, particularly the way Kyler got on board with him down the stretch. You know, now Wilson's not going to stretch you the way Marvin Harrison is, for sure, but it's not like we don't have anyone who can play it. And they've got all these great other wide receivers in other rounds. And if you got multiple picks, I mean, I could see a scenario where the Cardinals could draft Ladd McConkey like at the beginning of the second round and be happier than clams. I mean, that kid's a baller. I mean, but, and then Leggett from South Carolina is special. I mean, add Mitchell, The kid's 6'4" and runs like the wind. I mean, there are just so many really good wide receivers that you can kick that can down the road and still get a really good one. And it wouldn't surprise me, like last year, the big buzz wide receiver was Tank Dell for so long until he got hurt. And what was Tank Dell taking?
Third round, I believe. Yeah. I don't remember the pick, but I believe it was third round.
I think you're right. I think it was third round pick 69.
Mm-hmm.
Take it. I mean, almost made it to top 70 for a talent like that. So,
see, how funny is that? That in last year's wide receiver class, the two best coming out of it were potentially top of the third round and fifth round between Tank Dell and Puka Nacua.
Right. Yeah. See, look at that. Great example. I mean, Puka Nacua.
And go back to 2021. I believe a fourth round pick was Mr. Amon-Ra St. Brown, too.
There you go. I mean, the thing between all three of those guys is how versatile they are. I'm telling you, versatility is the name of the game. Today's football, because think of how all three of those guys help you win over the middle. And they're tough. They're tough outs, all three of them. Tough kids. I mean, look what Debo did over the middle and Ayuk did over the middle for and Kittle for the 49ers. So, yeah. The other big question we've been kicking around on Revenge of the Birds this week is, do you move Paris Johnson Jr. over to left tackle, or do you keep him at right tackle and try to draft a left tackle? So I did an article on that, and the numbers suggest that if you want a really good left tackle, you either grab Alt or Fashanu in the first round, first pick, or the other one that stands out is Jordan Morgan from Arizona, who might be on the board at 27 or at 35. But otherwise, all the best tackles are going to be right tackles at 27 with J.C. Latham, with Amarius Mims. Now, he's a guy I'm kind of intrigued about because he's a physical, specimen. But he's only played 8 college games because of injuries, and he's had to wait his turn to get into that Alabama lineup. But he missed 7 games last year with an ankle, had a procedure on it. So that makes me nervous, is you're getting a guy with, medical red flags. And it might be just a fluke. Who knows? But only playing 8 games means he's raw. I mean, same thing with Tyler Guyton from Oklahoma. The kid's 20 years old, and he's all kinds of talented, but he is raw and technique-wise, he's got a lot to go. So, I mean, those guys are right tackles for sure, so you'd move Paris Johnson Jr. over to the left, which we thought. So I say many of us on the board at Revenge of the Birds felt like PJJ should have been left tackle from day one and were disappointed. But made the argument that, down the stretch last year, I did the stats. I mean, PFF grades prior to Kyler starting were in the mid-50s. And then for the last 8 games with Kyler starting, were in the high 60s. So Paris Johnson made stark improvement between first half of the season to second half. But I also matched up his grades versus his teammate, DeJuan Jones at Ohio State. DeJuan Jones had a far superior season at right tackle than PJJ. I mean, the numbers just tilt heavily in favor of Jones, particularly penalties. I mean, that PJJ had like 12 or 14. DeJuan Jones had like 3. And then that's just the production. which was the argument we made why you don't put Paris Johnson at right tackle, because it was his third position change in 3 years from right guard to left tackle to right tackle in his last three years. That's a lot. And, you know, moving sides as an edge protector is a big deal. In fan techniques, you know, how to do it from left side versus right side, there's a whole new learning curve there, and you got to develop the muscle memory. So it is only logical that he would keep improving during the season. I think it really helped when Kyler came back. And he developed some really good chemistry with Will Hernandez at right guard. So there's a, you know, reason to just say, hey, you made your push in the second half. Let's keep you there. Kyle, your thoughts? What do you think?
I'm trusting your instincts on Paris Johnson Jr. to move him to the left tackle position. When I did my offseason plan a few weeks ago, I was in the camp of just go out and pay the $15 million a year for a solid right tackle who happens to be in this free agent class. Doesn't have to be a top end one, but
right.
DeJuan Jones is a great case last year of like, there are first round talents that are going to slide in the draft. And it happens every year. I mean, even Josh Jones for the Cardinals was a first round projected tackle that year. And I think it was 2020 and he slid right down to the third round. Like it happens every year. You just have to have the foresight to be able to wait and it's why tackles end up falling a lot, because teams either sign their tackles outright or they go through the draft process and they think, well, we don't really have a spot to fit this guy in. And, you know, only the most versatile of tackles end up playing the interior guard positions. So you kind of have to have some foresight there. But I don't think the Cardinals should. Kelvin Beachum is kind of an interesting case. Do you have any update about what you think is going to happen with Beachum? Because I guess if Beachum is there, yeah, it makes things a little bit easier because you have a right tackle in place if you, per se, don't sign one outright in free agency or sign someone to a one-year contract to essentially be the backup.
Yeah, that's a great point, because we've got, let's not sleep on the beach. I mean, we have him under contract. I mean, he's a great guy to have in this scenario, because I don't think he's going to be a better answer at left tackle than PJJ by any stretch. So that would behoove flipping PJJ over to left tackle and inserting Kelvin Beachum at right tackle, where he played very good football for years for the Cardinals. And you got to give Beachum credit. He came in for DJ for the last 2.5 games and for the one game where DJ was, you know, was ejected against the Seahawks. And he played solid football. It was, you know, he held his own, put it that way, which I had my doubts, because playing left tackle at that age for him was going to be a real challenge. And it still sticks in my craw that he just gave away Josh Jones and never gave him a legit chance, in my opinion. But, and that was another thing I proposed, is why not sign Josh Jones back? He's not going to be that expensive. And we saw a 9-game start stretch where he had the highest grades across the board on not only the offensive line, but on all offensive players. And actually, he had the highest PFF grade on the entire team in 2022.
Yeah. I mean, So Beachum being there, I think, helps in terms of, you know, they have the flexibility to wait, because I think Beachum at this stage of his career is probably what you might call like a replacement level starter in the NFL. Like he's probably closer to a backup than he is a top 15 tackle in the league at this point. But having him on the team makes it easier, because you know you can plug him and play him and probably get, you know, 75% of the snaps out of him at the right tackle position. But you just, to get a DeJuan Jones, you have to have the patience to make it through free agency without signing a tackle, making it through the first round of the draft without selecting a tackle. You got to have some real patience, because you just don't know who's going to slide in the draft or who's going to you know, be available in the day two picks. So,
well, and DeJuan Jones was a day three pick.
Exactly. And he was getting some first round grades, and he's just a giant physical specimen, which with okay, for simple football thing for people listening, like offensive and defensive line are very often like the positions that are most closely associated with look at their physical gifts, and that will most likely answer whether or not they're going to succeed or not. Like most, I think the average Pro Bowl defensive lineman is a 4.5-star recruit coming out of high school. So it's easier to translate some of those things. So offensive and defensive line, you can predict a little bit based on their physical tools, physical skill sets, whether or not they'll have success in the NFL or not. And there's, you mentioned Alt and the tackles at the top of the draft this year. Those guys are very, very good, but you very often see a depth of tackles fall in the draft because once teams have their tackles in place, they don't really need to draft depth at that position because you don't see a lot of tackles playing guard or tackles moving to guard / center.
Right.
Yeah. So I could see it both ways. I said they should go out and sign a Jonah Williams or just lock down, pay the extra in free agency to lock down the right tackle position because of how important I think it is. But that doesn't preclude them from also waiting until the draft to potentially go right tackle.
Yeah, I kind of like that option too. I like having Beach as a valuable, plug-in guy who could start, and he's durable. I mean, he's the only starter who lasted 17 games in 2022. All the rest were out by mid-season, practically. Of course, that happens when you miss OTAs and stuff like that. So the way that offensive line did. But the guy I really like is Jermaine Illuminor for the Raiders right tackle, who's a free agent, had coming off a really good year, and he's big and strong, good against the run. But also you have the tackles in day two or early day three on round four. A couple of them stand out to me. Is Christian Jones from Texas, I thought, really caught my eye at the Senior Bowl. Boy, he looks the part to me. He could be a nice surprise. Also, I really like the kid from Notre Dame, the right tackle from Notre Dame, Blake Fisher. I think he's got good potential. And also Roger Rosengarten from Washington, who protected Michael Penix's backside as a right tackle because Penix is a lefty. Had one rough game in the championship game with two holding calls, one of which I didn't think was merited, but I saw him play great games prior to that against Oregon and Texas that got him to that game. So, I don't discredit him for a couple mistakes in that last game. I don't think that, if you look at his entire body of work last season, I thought he was really good. Plus, he pulls well. He has some of the attributes there, the feet that, Clayton Adams and Drew Petzing want out of their offensive linemen. So I think this is something they can get later. I also think wide receiver is something they can get later. What I think where it might be really good for the Cardinals to do is focus on defense with at least their second and third picks. And take the best playmaker they can get on offense or tackle they can get with a bit of a trade down. And I have a feeling I've sort of felt this, but the more and more I look at the numbers and what the Cardinals draft board might look like, it just seems to me like if they got the kind of offer that they want it for, they're probably going to take it. And
when it comes to the true wide receiver position, not necessarily like skill position with tight ends included, but just specifically wide receivers, you made a great point a couple weeks ago that if you're looking for a fourth or fifth receiver, a 1-year contract for Jalen Guyton of the Chargers makes a ton of sense because he played with Kyler Murray back at Allen High School. And that's a perfect 1-year low risk. He's, on the fringes of staying in the NFL at this point. That's a great 1 year, you know, guy to go sign and just see what comes of it if you bring in Kyler's former star receiver from high school.
Right. I think a telling thing would be if they somehow re-sign Marquise Brown, I don't think you're seeing Harrison or wide receiver at the first pick. I don't think you can make that kind of a financial investment and then go turn right back around and use your top pick on a wide receiver. I wouldn't imagine that. So, that's why I don't think they will sign Marquise Brown, not to the kind of money he might want or command. Although that might be difficult coming off two injury-riddled seasons in Arizona. So there's a lot in flux there regarding him. I mean, he's the only Cardinal free agent on anyone's top 100. And, you know, I think most of the pundits in PFF, I think, have him rated in the 40s somewhere. So of top free agents. So, you know, that's a situation that bears watching, see what happens with him and what the Cardinals. I mean, he said he wants to re-sign in Arizona. He wants to stay with Kyler. And he said the team gave him the indication they would like to do that too. But, you know, largely depends on the numbers and whatever else. So, but, top of the draft looks absolutely fascinating. A lot of stuff's going to happen between now and, you know, April, at the end, you know, end of April. And it's going to be, you know, should be exciting to look at and see what the possibilities are. And, you know, for right now, I mean, I'd say odds of trading out of four, no, even if Marvin Harrison Jr. is there, are better than 50-50, depending on the offer they get. If it's the offer's good enough, I think they're going to take it. That's just a theory. We'll see as time goes by, and hopefully, God willing. And I want to thank Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter. Wish him a happy vacation down in San Diego. And thanks to all of you for your continued support. We had a nice turnout for Marcos Labrada last week. Let's keep it rolling. And in the interim, may the red rain shower down on you into the red, red sea. Red rain.